I'm Andrew.
And I'm Spencer, and you're listening to the At a Distance podcast from The Slowdown. Today, we'll be speaking with the forest ecologist, Dr. Suzanne Simard. A professor of forest ecology at the University of British Columbia, she is also the author of the new book, Finding the Mother Tree, Discovering the Wisdom of the Forest.
She is one of the most rigorous and forward-thinking scientists studying plant communication and behavior, and she's best known for the research she's conducted on the underground networks of forests characterized by fungi and roots.
Suzanne has forever changed how people view trees and their connections to one another, and she continues to open our eyes to the far-reaching implications of forests. Let's get her on the line. Hi, Suzanne. Welcome to At a Distance. It's so great to have you with us today.
Thank you, Spencer. Thanks for having me.
So just to kick things off, wanted to get into a deep question. How far do you think the consciousness or awareness of trees extends? And can they perceive humans?
Oh, those are such brilliant questions. And I don't know the full answer to them. But so trees live in forests. The forest is this social system. And what I've discovered is that trees are all connected together below ground and communicate through these mycelial networks, these fungal networks. And trees are linked to trees, to trees, to trees. So the whole forest is linked together. Messages transmit between trees that are adjacent to each other. That's what we've studied for the most part. But we're also trying to see how far those messages go. We started looking at nutrients and like nitrogen and phosphorus and water and carbon. And right now we're looking at how salmon nitrogen ends up in trees, which is fascinating. And then how far that nitrogen transmits deeply into the forest and how far the influence into the forest is. And my guess is that it's really far, you know, as long as they're connected together, but the signal will decline as you go further into the forest. But then there's other signals being picked up. So I would say, you know, the forest is a whole communicating system. But individuals, their messages, we don't know how far those messages actually go. But we think, you know, from tree to tree to tree, like going through clothesline link to clothesline.
Can they perceive humans?
Can they perceive humans? Yeah. I mean, why wouldn't they? That's my first answer. And my scientific answer is yes, when we pull their needles off, they go into this big stress response and we can measure the biochemical cascades of compounds being produced in these intermediary pathways and that they actually transmit that stress that they're feeling from us plucking off their needles to their neighboring trees.
Oh,
so
wow.
Yes, they can perceive it. We've measured it and compared it against like a worm eating their needles and it is different.
Mm. Could our voices or sounds, human-made sounds, have a relationship with them? Could they respond to that?
I haven't studied it, but you know they respond to all kinds of movements of air. And of course, air moves in wavelengths and so does light and so do our, you know, voices. Mm. And so they can perceive wind and sounds of other creatures like bees and birds, and because they depend on pollination, they depend on dispersal of their seeds by these creatures. They send signals, their aromas, their pollen. And so even though I haven't studied how they perceive the sounds of our voices, I would say, why not?
Mm.
If they can perceive all these other things that we have studied.
What about pain? Do they have pain perception or memory?
I wouldn't call it pain because I don't know if they feel like what we feel, but they definitely know when they've been injured. They know when an herbivore is eating them. They know when they've been infected by a pathogen. So it would be like, you know, if I broke my arm, I would feel pain and I would have a stress response that would affect my whole biochemistry. They have that, a stress response that affects their biochemistry as well. Is that pain? Well, that's a human word to ascribe to human feelings, but they definitely have responses that are immediate and dramatic.
A lot of your work is so much about this communication between trees, but also you found that they help each other. Why would they be motivated to help another? It doesn't sound very kind of Darwinian. Don't we think of them as all fighting for the light?
Well, certainly that has been the historic since Darwin came up with his theories of natural selection and that it was based on competitive exclusion and speciation resulting from that. Darwin also knew that plants and organisms collaborate and work together as well and wrote about it. But the idea of competition driving natural selection really took root at the same time that capitalism was really being developed in Europe as our economic system. And so they kind of went together, like those writings all came out at the same time. But I would say that the findings are not anti-Darwinian, or they're just that they make a bigger picture. They help us understand better the multitude of interactions that drive species to evolve and also to, you know, to live together. And I mean, think of a forest too. Like I live in old growth forests. I've been around them my whole life. They are all intimately linked together, standing beside each other for hundreds, if not thousands of years, some nestled under the crowns of others, some wrapped around each other, their root systems entwined. There's so much that they collaborate over, you know, how to filter light through the canopy. You know, some will use different wavelengths that's filtered through an upper canopy, for example. Others will use nitrogen that maybe another tree has fixed, like alder, and then it's available to the pines and the firs. So there is all kinds of evidence of collaboration in forests. And so my short answer, of course, they collaborate. Yeah. And of course, they compete at the same time as well. They have these sophisticated relationships.
And generally, it's about the benefit of the collective forest. Have you found that certain trees are not collaborating with other trees?
I mean, it's true that trees do compete for light and resources. They do that. And certain trees occupy similar niche spaces. There's some trees, for example, that grow really tall, really fast. Like in my neck of the woods, larch and white pine and Douglas fir are the fast growing species. And so they do, you know, stratify in height, and that they would compete more directly with each other for light. But below them, there's a whole suite of species that are using these other far right red wavelengths, the cedars and the hemlocks. And so they're sort of in this separate place where they're avoiding competition with each other. So it depends, like it's a sophisticated place. It depends on the species. It depends on how they've evolved to deal with light and how to access nutrients and water.
Hmm. What is kin selection? What is this idea?
Kin selection is something that, well, all animals, humans do. Like, you know, I recognize my own children. You recognize your own children and family, and we have a strong bond to them. That is, and we favor them, right? We look after these children so that they grow, you know, and that they all reproduce as well, if you're thinking in a species point of view. And what we found out is that trees do this too, right? That they are able to recognize which trees around them are related to them. They can detect the relatedness. They can detect the species. They can detect if they're the same species. They can detect their relationship within a species. So yeah, they have this ability. And that grew out of earlier research done on smaller plants by other researchers in the last couple of decades. But now we know that trees actually also do this.
So if there were two Doug firs next to each other and a white birch nearby, it's going to help the Doug fir before it helps the white birch?
According to our studies, that is true. Yes, that is true. They can detect if those two firs are related, then they will favor. They'll give them more carbon. They'll shrink their root systems to provide elbow room for their relatives. Mm. Whereas if it's a non-kin, they'll expand their root systems to try to outcompete them. Mm. So they just, they make room for their kin.
Amazing.
In your new book, you write, this is not a book about how we can save the trees. This is a book about how the trees might save us. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask, could you speak to this dichotomy, this idea of like how we might begin to shift our perspective to giving trees and fungi or basically any non-human species agency?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely actually essential that we do this, that we recognize their agency, that we recognize them as equal to us, that we are all in this together, which so many Aboriginal people in the world recognize and say, we are one, we are all in this together. Mm. You know, so many languages have words for this. The English language is a little bit bereft of those kinds of terms, but yeah, it's essential. And the reason it's essential that we recognize the agency of trees and plants and other plants and animals is that these are our life support systems, right? We depend on healthy ecosystems. Without healthy ecosystems, we won't be here, right? There'll be a great deal of suffering if we trash our ecosystems, which we seem to be doing at a pretty rapid rate, which we've got to change that, right? The way to change that is to respect nature as though it is our life support system. Let me give you a few numbers on life support. What I mean by that, forests, for example, they store like 85% of terrestrial carbon, right? If we had no forests, that would all get released to the atmosphere and completely swamp our atmospheric CO2 levels. Mm. They are home to 80% of species worldwide, right? Terrestrial species. And, you know, deforestation is the primary cause of species extinctions. Canadian forests are, you know, provide 80% of our fresh water to Canada. And probably, you know, our Canadian forests provide a lot of the fresh water and electricity for America as well. Mm. So you can quickly see how these systems are absolutely essential to the basics of what we need. Oxygen comes from photosynthesis, from forests.
On the subject of science, you know, you've gone on so many scientific expeditions over the years, and I was wondering if you could speak to the importance of these trips and of science more generally in terms of us better understanding our planet, and if you could share some of the most sort of profound or eye-opening findings from these trips.
Well, you know, I've done most of my work in my home forest. So when I say home forest, I mean the West Coast forests of North America, mostly in British Columbia. And I think that this has been an essential part of my research. So yeah, many trips, but many trips within British Columbia. This is a philosophical question that to science, which is so important, I think. You know, when I came into academia, you know, they really push us to publish in the best journals with the most universal rules about, you know, explaining the world we live in, to try to make sense of the world we live in. And yet forests and knowledge about forests and ecosystems means knowing your local place, right? To know that local community, and our Aboriginal knowledge systems are based on being one, learning about systems in that way of knowing, is to know that place, to know when the salmonberry is blooming, to know when the insects are starting to hatch and the larvae and the bugs are starting to come out, to know when the salmon run. Because then we know when to harvest the fish and how much to take and what not to take. It's being attuned to those ecosystems. And as we struggle with our existential issues of climate change and, you know, habitat destruction and species losses, you know, we've got to come back to that local knowledge. That is where the answers lie. Mm. What we've done so far is we've treated like all of North America as though it's all the same. You know, as far as forestry goes, we're just clear cut and plant trees. That's all we do. Well, there are so many ways to work with the forest.
Yeah.
You know, to take out one or two trees and listen to the forest and not take more than we need. But that requires knowledge of that place. So my journeys have mostly been in BC to understand those places. And I think it's allowed me to see these ecosystems in really deep ways.
Hmm. Well, I think it's important what you bring up about sort of balancing the philosophical with the scientific. Could you elaborate a little bit on that and also maybe speak to the relationships between Indigenous or Aboriginal communities and trees and forests? You know, what can be learned from them in terms of building resiliency, a healthy, more balanced relationship with nature?
I think in Western science, if we look way back, and of course, I'm a settler. My family came from France and moved across Quebec and into British Columbia. And the settlers brought to North America Western science and Western ways of thinking. And Western science has separated man from nature. We view ourselves as above, or even our religions, right? The Christian religion is that man has sort of dominion over nature, that we go forth and multiply. Mm-hmm. And that idea that we are superior and above nature has provided the avenue or given us a license, we think, to exploit nature for our own benefits. And this is where we've gotten into trouble. So not just how we manage forests, but also how we do science, right? We do science, we reduce it down to its little parts. We try to say, okay, I'm going to take, you know, if it was a human being, I'm going to take the heart out and I'm going to take the brain out and I'm going to study these separately. Or I'm going to just study the bark of a tree and I'm going to study the leaves separately. And in doing that, we miss the system level stuff. And I remember in graduate school, we were studying competition between plants, and we were always overjoyed when we could explain like 40% of the variation and how that plant grew because of competition. It was like, oh, the holy grail. But what about that other 60% we didn't understand? Mm. Well, we ignored it, right? We said, oh, it's unexplained variation. Well, that's where the magic happens. That's where health happens. That's where diversity happens. The global carbon cycles, they turn around that mysterious stuff. And that's where we need to get back to. That's where the missing part. Because if you follow the management around the stuff, that little part you do know, and ignore the rest, that's where all these mistakes start coming in, right? Clear-cutting out all the big old trees, well, and trying to grow back the big competitors instead of trying to grow back a forest. It's because we missed that magical part. I call it magical, but it's really that those system level properties. In complexity science, we call those emergent properties, things that emerge out of the parts themselves. The total is greater than the sum of the parts. Mm. It's an important part of science that we're just emerging from the reductionist to understand this more system level science.
Growing up, you had a grandfather and uncles who were horse loggers. You must have seen firsthand what system level thinking was by seeing how they work. Can you tell us a little bit about that? What a horse logger is?
Yes. So my great grandfather, my uncles, my dad, they were all horse loggers. And so everything was slow and small, right? My grandfather built all of his own boats, his own tools, his own flumes, his own water wheel to generate electricity, houseboats that we lived on the lake while they logged. And everything was slow, right? It was like, you know, they started out using cross-cut saws, and it would take 3 days to cut down a tree. And then there was the first chainsaw, which required two men, one on each side. It was like a cross-cut saw, but it had a little engine in it. Mm. Still took a day to cut down a tree. And my grandfather would go up and with the boys into the woods, and he would lay out, you know, make a little map of the trees for that day. And he'd say, okay, we're going to cut this tree, one tree. And so they would take one tree. And then get it, you know, with the horses, get it on the flume and then flume down to the lake. I mean, it was a huge, these are huge trees. And the horses were huge and the flumes were huge, but everything was slow. And so when you stood back and looked, you couldn't tell that they'd actually taken a tree out of there because they grew back so fast, right? The seeds came in, they regenerated quickly. And the signature, I call it the signature of my grandfather on the landscape, was so light that when you're out on the lake looking up at the mountains, you can't see where they logged because it's just these little gaps they created in the forest. And so that showed to me in this really deep way, because I grew up around it, how, you know, careful, selective logging is really rejuvenating for the forest. We can do this and not destroy the forest. And we see the examples of this around the world. I haven't been to the Menominee Forest, but apparently they're producing more trees, more wood by selective logging than they started out with. And I would say the same is true with what my grandfather and his dad did as well.
Yeah.
There are ways to do this. We just have to slow down.
There are ways to do it. We have to slow down. And also that clear cutting and sort of grid-based agriculture for trees actually doesn't work well, right, is what you've found.
Well, I mean, take these cathedral forests, right? I mean, literally, they're cathedrals. I mean, trees that are, you know, 60 meters tall. They're huge and they're big, like 6 meters in diameter, if you can imagine that. They're as big as your house, you know, almost around. And these trees are all entwined with each other, growing together, and you can't replace that. Right. When we cut these down, and I, just as a comment on this, in British Columbia, where I live, which I grew up in a province of old growth forests, it's now a province of clear cuts. And we're fighting for the last 3% of these iconic old growth forests. And if you've heard about the protests on Vancouver Island, it is about these forests. And what the companies want to do, what they've been given license to do, is cut them down and turn them into these grids of plantations. These are not the same thing. These old growth forests, they store tons of carbon. They're homes to so many species of fungi and animals and birds and plants that depend on old growth conditions. And when we log these forests, that's going to be lost. These trees are thousands of years old, 1,000, 2,000 years. The oldest trees are the bristlecone pines that I know of in North America that are 5,000 years old. They've been here a long, long time. They've seen a lot, right? They've seen climate changes. They've seen changes in the landscape, the other plants around them, and that's encoded in their genes. It's in their seeds. And so those are the seeds that are going to be resilient or adaptable as climate changes. Those are going to be our answer to the future climate, so that we can move these seeds around so that they can, you know, regenerate these forests. And so we're not just cutting down, you know, losing biodiversity from species level or losing carbon, we're losing our future forests too. You know, I can't emphasize enough how important it is to save these old forests.
Hmm. Right. The tree itself has a sort of epistemic bank that will get us through the future. And that's what's being thrown away.
Yeah, essentially.
Fascinating. In 1997, you published a piece in Nature called The Wood Wide Web. And it's important to note that this is only a couple of years after anyone was on the web. I mean, this is very, very early.
Yeah.
3 years, I guess.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was met with mixed reviews. Some people, you know, thought it was a little crazy. This is when you really started presenting your ideas. Mm-hmm. So I was curious, when I was reading about that, how that period was for you and what you learned about the ways in which you might need to present radical ideas to a wide public.
Yeah, that's such a great question. I don't know all the answers to it. I'm still learning. But when I started this research, it was 1992, which was the year that the internet was invented, or, you know, that we all started to see it.
Tim Berners-Lee. Yeah.
And so I was studying the below-ground web as the World Wide Web was being invented. And so that was prescient in a way. I mean, my work was, they were both prescient for each other in some ways. And then when I presented my work to the world, you're right, it met a huge resistance, both from the academic side. So there was the challenge to Darwinianism, but more so, it was more challenging to biologists who were really, you know, so steeped in this idea that competition structured plant communities, all communities, really. I mean, you see it through agriculture, you see it through forestry. You know, these concepts are prevalent and they've shaped how we manage ecosystems. And so to change that philosophy isn't just changing a philosophy, it's changing a whole way of being, a whole way of governing our lives. And so academics were skeptical because, you know, they're so steeped in Darwinianism, and Lynn Margulis was just coming out with her ideas of endosymbiosis. She was rejected. You know, her papers were difficult to publish. Eventually, she did get her work in and into the mainstream. And it's been verified now that we understand about the human genome, where we know that our genome is made up of many species, right? It's not just the human. It's an evolution and endosymbiosis of many species coming together. We see evidence of virus DNA and bacterial DNA in our DNA. But that's been an evolution. And so, of course, when I was presenting my work to the world, that was not mainstream understanding. It was still very much this old way of thinking. And so I hit the wall with that. And then from the management point of view, there's a whole infrastructure behind managing ecosystems in a certain way. There's money invested. There are companies developed. There are technologies developed. And all of that is hard to derail. It's like, how do we get off fossil fuels when our whole infrastructure is designed around fossil fuels? It's a difficult thing. Mm-hmm. And so I hit that against the wall as well. And, you know, it's been a slow process. It's still not changed. As far as communicating these things, what have I learned? I've learned you don't go out on your own. And it's hard to go out on your own and receive the backlash. You need to have protections. You need to have your group around you. You need to have advocates, you know, people that will help protect you, because the backlash is quite amazing.
Well, it's so interesting because this idea of ideology and science, it's mm-hmm. like they were meeting science with ideology. And that continues today, obviously, in massive ways. But why do you think it is that, you know, you're presenting an idea that is, I want to know, and I'm just going to tell you what I found out. And this mm-hmm. is empirical. Mm-hmm. This is not an idea. And right. what they're meeting you with is an idea. So did you ever kind of come back and say, why are you so sure?
I did. Yeah. I always thought, you know, the way that we're managing our ecosystems by simplifying them and, you know, getting rid of the things we don't want is a really risky business, right? We're putting these ecosystems at huge risk by reducing biodiversity, because we know ecosystem function goes down with lack of biodiversity. But what they said to me is, if we enact what you're saying, you know, to leave native plants and to leave old mother trees, and that's way too risky. You know, that's making it too risky that we're not going to guarantee the income that we've had in the past from these trees, because these, you know, you're allowing nature to run amok. You know, then we can't predict what we're going to get in the future. And so I'm like, no, what you're doing is too risky. So yeah, I did sort of come back at them with their own hypocrisies, right? And try to show them that this, what you're thinking is it puts us all at this enormous risk ecologically.
Why do you think it is now? I mean, your ideas since then took off. I mean, James Cameron used your idea in the Avatar with the biological neural network. Multiple books and articles have come out. You've given these incredibly spirited talks. And I'd love to hear from you a little bit about how you use the power of metaphor, basically, in storytelling to advance knowledge in your public work. Mm-hmm. And in your written work, it's quite objective. It's this is what's been found. And mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit about those two modalities you have to exist in to push your ideas forward.
Yeah, I don't think of them as two modalities, but it is, you're right. So if you want to publish your work, scientific work, you need to follow the recipe, right? Journals are very strict in what they will allow you to talk about. And I needed to get my science reviewed because peer review is the cornerstone of advancing science. I needed to do that. I needed to be able to establish myself as a credible scientist. And the way you do that is to publish your work. And so I set about doing that. I knew I had to do that. And it wasn't until my story was fuller that I started gaining the confidence to step outside the bounds of scientific discourse to talk about it in more holistic ways. It's not just that my science was developed. I could see the crisis that was building, right? I have my eye on climate change. I have my eye on biodiversity loss. I know that we've only got 3% of our old growth forests. I know the Amazon is in trouble. We have to step out of our little silos. Maybe not all scientists will do this. I'm not saying everybody has to do this, but if you have, you know, if you have the strength and you have the story and you feel the imperative, like it's a human, it's my obligation, you know, I feel it as an obligation to the land, to the people, to who we are, to say, this is what I know, because I've seen the work ignored for decades, really, right? It's not being used in forestry even now. It's still the same old stuff. And so I thought I've got to step out and tell people where we're going wrong and how we can do better. Mm. And I'm hopeful that, you know, in doing this, that we will get traction on this. People will hear this and start pushing their governments to do better. They need to do a lot better.
To that point, I mean, your work resonates with people hugely now, at least in certain circles. You know, it seems like it's really just starting now. Do you think that has any relationship to a growing generation that does see a kind of whole earth perspective, a kind of oneness?
I don't know if it's a generational thing. I mean, like, I've got two girls, 21 and 23. You know, they've grown up knowing that climate is changing and species are disappearing and icebergs are calving off. And there's a grief, right? There's a grief. There's a worry. They've grown up under this stress. They don't know what the future holds. We have like these predictions that in 10 years that things could really go awry. Like, how do you live in those conditions? And so, yeah, they have that awareness. But what this work really taps into is what we all have in us. And that is that we are creatures of this earth. We're a species. We're animals. We live in among and depend on all the other creatures in this world, even though we've pretended previously that we don't, but we're hitting up against this, right? We know, we see now. So it's really just getting back to our own Aboriginal roots of who we are, which are people of this earth. And so I think young people, their minds are more flexible, and they're worried, and they know that we have to find solutions, and they're working hard to get it moving. So they've embraced this more readily than, you know, the previous, my generation previously, that we're more about let's exploit the earth for as much profit as we possibly can get. I count my generation in there.
On the future-looking front, in 2015, you started the Mother Tree Project. And I was wondering if you could speak about what led to it and also what your aims are, your hopes, your ambitions.
So this is a project I started in 2015. I got a nice grant from the Government of Canada. So what I wanted to do was I wanted to take this basic fundamental research on connection in trees, which really, hearkening back, it's that work arose out of my concern, an applied world of looking at, you know, what was going wrong in our forests. And then I did this basic research. And then, you know, I sort of stayed in this world of basic research for a couple of decades and going, this is not getting any uptake. You know, we've got to move on this. And so then I started the Mother Tree Project to demonstrate and to explore how do we save these old trees for all of the functions that they have in ecosystems. How do we do it? Do we leave individual trees? Do we leave them in clusters? Do we thin them out? You know, what species do we leave? And so that's what we're doing. And we're doing it across this huge climate gradient. It's 900 kilometers long. It's an area the size of Denmark with all these mountains and variable climates. And we're looking at how all these different ways we can save these old trees compared to clear cutting, which is the standard operating practice in Canada, and looking at what is the impact of what we do on biodiversity, on carbon storage, and on the resilience of the forest. And we're finding out that, you know, for one thing that we're finding out is that not the same thing works everywhere, you know, that we need to be attuned to the land, but that under stressful conditions, that if we're going to start moving trees, which we need to do, because they're never going to be able to keep up with the velocity of climate change, we've got to assist the migration of trees. If we do that, we're going to be introducing them into these, you know, pretty scary environments for them. And what we're finding is that when you leave these old mother trees behind, they nurture them along. They bring them along. They increase the survival of these new migrants. And so already we're seeing this, you know, we've gotten phenomenal new information. We know now that below ground, there is as much carbon as there is above ground, for example, and we need to keep that carbon in the ground. And we can do that by leaving old trees behind, even while cutting out a few. So what we're finding out is basically what my grandfather knew all along, you know, it's what he practiced. And I'm showing it in a scientific realm and publishing the work. And then people can come and look and they can say, oh, you know, I could try that in my forest.
Earlier, you referenced complexity science, and I was hoping you could explain what that is to our listeners.
Yeah, so I talked a little bit about reductionism, right? That Western science really arose out of reductionist science. And I use reductionist science too. It does get you a long way. You can figure out a lot, right? I use reductionist science to figure out that birch and firs share carbon back and forth in these little groups of seedlings I planted. But what did it mean in the broader ecosystem? I didn't know. And the only way you can do that is to look at the whole forest over the lifespan and the size span that they grow in at their scale. And it's hard to do experiments like that. It's almost impossible. I do them, but it's hard and not everybody can. You need to understand also how it interacts with other systems like social systems and economic systems and biological systems. And so out of this reductionist science, out of the frustration of not knowing how our results were fitting in the bigger world, these more complex problems arose this area called complex adaptive system science. And it arose really, I mean, and probably in many labs around the world, but there was the Resilience Alliance in Stockholm, Sweden, which is sort of the birthplace of those ideas. And they were applying it to social ecological systems. And so then I've just started using those ideas and realizing that what I study, that's exactly what I'm looking at, right, is how these systems work. So embedding the reductionist science, understanding the mechanistic science within the broader, you know, emergent science, which is complex system science. And the basic philosophy is, it's really simple, is that systems are self-organized systems. They self-organize based on relationships between the parts. You could think of an ecosystem with all the species, the soil organisms, the trees and so on. They all have relationships with each other. Just like in our social systems, we have relationships with each other, our families, our friends, the broader community. And it's those relationships that produce these ecosystem level properties. In complexity science, they call them emergent properties. And so that would be like in an ecosystem, it would be like the health of the forest or the ability to clean water and regulate hydrology. In a human system, an emergent thing could be, you could think of like an orchestra with all the wind and percussion and, you know, the flutes and the brass and in and of themselves, they're beautiful. But when you put them together, you get a symphony. And that is an emergent thing, is the symphony, the sound, that beautiful sound that comes together. So you can't get that from reducing systems to their parts.
I was wondering if you could share some thoughts or ideas around some active ways in which we can be thinking about how to heal our relationship with nature, if not actually heal nature itself quickly. And did COVID kind of help reveal, did the lockdown reveal some of these things somehow?
Yeah, I think it revealed a lot. I mean, it's kind of like a restart point for us. It's an opportunity for us, and we should take it, right? Is to realize that when we're disconnected from each other, because we are, like I said, we're animal creatures, we're social animals. Trees are social creatures. But as social animals, when we've been disconnected, we realize how we don't thrive, right? We need our friends. We need to go to the pub and have a good conversation and a good laugh, or whatever you do, right? And so one of the things people have been able to do is they've been able to go outside. And so they've kind of had the opportunity to rediscover their relationship with outside. And I would encourage people to enrich that. And the easiest way to do it is just, you know, go sit somewhere. What I do with my students when because I teach second year students, like they're 19 or 20, I take them into the forest and we just sit there for 5 minutes and listen to the forest. And at first it's uncomfortable, like, because they've all, you know, they're always on their phones and talking to each other and there's always noise. And to sit even for a minute is hard. Just listen. 5 minutes. After a couple minutes, you can hear the fidgeting starts to slow down, right? And then they start to relax a little bit. And then 5 minutes, they're actually, and I ask them, okay, what did you hear? And they talk about, you know, that little whisper in the grass, that little bird that was over there that we all heard. And, you know, that squirrel that was chattering away as it was eating its seeds. They heard it. And then I take them out over and over again and really connect them with all the parts of the ecosystem. And by the end of the course, they're like, I don't want to stop. I want to go back to the forest, right? They're hooked. They're in it. They're part of it. And that's what we all need to do, because it's too easy to ignore the travesties out there when you're not connected to it. It's too easy to ignore that we're cutting down the last old growth in the Amazon and the West Coast. We just get so wrapped up in our daily lives, but we have to care because our lives depend on it. And so I think that, you know, doing that simple step is that's the crucial first step. Mm. And then once you've got that in your heart, right? Once that little hummingbird is right in your heart and you want to care for it, then you're going to start acting, voting properly. I shouldn't say properly, voting in certain ways, supporting organizations that are out there on the front lines trying to protect, you know, supporting protesters if that need be, you know, making sure that if you're investing in things, that it's not for destructive industries. Mm. There are so many things you can do once you've got that in your heart.
Mm-hmm. So as we emerge from this strange period, this pandemic, the lockdown, whatever we can call it now, it's ongoing. Whenever we emerge from it, what's your greatest hope?
My greatest hope is that we don't forget. It'll be so easy to slip back into the old patterns, right? To not forget how important connection is to each other, how important, you know, having a civil society is to protect each other, be there, have your back. Right? To have each other's back, to know that we have love and protection all around us of our neighbors and our families and our communities. And that part of that community is our natural world, you know, our forests, our wetlands, our shorelands, you know, those are all part of us as well. And if you've been lucky enough to be out there, to just really bring it into your heart as your family, your tree people, your flower people, your strawberry people, become that. And I hope to, like, to just try to consume less, be more sustainable as individuals, right? Like, I remember looking at the airline map, for example, of the daily flights across the world pre-pandemic. And I was thinking, we can't keep going like this, right? You see people taking like a 2-week holiday here or 1 month, and then they're going somewhere else another month. And the world can't support this, right? Our footprint's too big. Mm-hmm. And so I hope that we pull back and say, what is more sustainable? We've got an opportunity here to change our habits.
Suzanne, thank you so much. It was really a treat to speak with you today.
Thank you very much. Those are really great questions.
Thanks for listening. To hear more episodes of At a Distance, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or Stitcher. You can follow us on Instagram at slowdown.tv. Sign up for our weekly newsletter, Exploring the Five Senses, head to our website at www.slowdown.tv.